VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting as leaders of the group of seven richest nations gather in Canada for an annual two-day summit. A key economic advisor to President Donald Trump said he's not backing away from his trade policies, which Larry Kudlow said are aimed at fixing a broken global trading system.
There are disagreements. He's sticking to his guns. But he's going to talk to them. Communication, the lines are open, the negotiations are ongoing.
The G7 meeting comes amid disputes over U.S. tariffs on aluminum and steel imports that have angered U.S. allies and prompted threats of retaliation. Kudlow said global trading system is broken, needs reform, and Mr. Trump is using tariffs to make those necessary changes.
I think free world trade is a very good thing indeed, but it is broken, and President Trump is trying to fix it, and that's a key point. As I've said before, I think he's the strongest trade reformer in many decades.
He said Mr. Trump's policies are aimed at free and reciprocal trade and growth.
My great hope is that our friends at the G7 will take notice of these policies and work with us to extend and expand them so we can have a prosperous U.S. and world economy.
Ahead of her participation in the G7 summit, German Chancellor Angela Merkel predicted difficult discussions ahead in Canada. Speaking to Parliament Wednesday, she said everybody knows we have difficult discussions on the economy, trade, climate protection, development and foreign policy, especially the U.S. decision to pull out of the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. Five Kenyan policemen were killed Wednesday when their vehicle detonated an improvised explosive device. The blast occurred in Harar village near the Kenya-Somali border. Authorities suspect it was planted by al-Shabaab militants. This is VOA News. In Guatemala, emergency crews pulled more bodies from what is left of villages devastated by the eruption of the Fuego volcano Sunday. With dozens still missing, authorities now put the death toll at 99. President Jimmy Morales was on scene assessing the damage and praised those searching for victims, calling them heroes. Thousands have been displaced and continued volcanic activity and rainfall are hampering recovery efforts. In Iraq, at least 16 were killed and dozens wounded Wednesday after an arms depot exploded in the Sadr district of Baghdad, causing widespread damage. The blast occurred as ammunition was being transferred. The Iraqi parliament passed a law Wednesday calling for a national manual recount of millions of votes for the May 12 legislative election following charges of violations. The move could delay the process of forming a new government won by the bloc backed by Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. A spokesman for the U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish Military Council Wednesday said Kurdish militia advisors will soon begin withdrawing from the northern town of Manbij. Shervan Darwish said advisors from the YPG, or People's Protection Units, will begin pulling out over the coming days, but warned his militia will not accept a Turkish military deployment to Manbij. The U.S. and Turkey reached agreement Monday on the withdrawal of Kurdish units that Ankara considers a terrorist group. The Health Ministry and Democratic Republic of Congo Wednesday said the death toll from the recent Ebola outbreak in the northwest has risen to 27. Nearly 60 confirmed cases have been recorded over the past month. In Jordan, hundreds returned to the streets Wednesday. They waved flags and shouted bread, freedom, and social justice. They oppose a government plan to raise taxes and cut bread subsidies, part of a debt reduction plan demanded by the International Monetary Fund. King Abdullah appointed former World Bank economist Omar al-Razaz as new prime minister to defuse tensions. Tens of thousands rallied in northern Greece Wednesday against a possible compromise over the dispute regarding the name Macedonia. The long disagreement has prevented the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia from joining NATO and the European Union. Greece objects to the name, which they say implies territorial claims over its region of the same name. Negotiations have narrowed the discussion to three choices: Upper Macedonia, Northern Macedonia, or New Macedonia. Strong economic data helped fuel a rally on Wall Street Wednesday, with the benchmark Dow Jones Index surging nearly 350 points to 25,146. The U.S. trade deficit, however, fell to a seven-month low, narrowing 2% to $46.2 billion in April. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 7th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. English-speaking Cameroon put forth demands for ending Amazonian insurrection.
We are not just asking for the release of the leaders of the movement. We are asking for the release of all Anglophones who've been arrested in and out of the country because of this struggle.
Nijon Frundi is founder and chairman of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. Uganda's president vows to continue infrastructure development. Ethiopia agrees to return to Eritrea, a disputed borderland. A Malawi High Court gives the government 30 days to transfer all child prisoners to safe homes. And the UN condemns recent crackdown of activists in Egypt.
In many cases, these people are detained without an arrest warrant. In some cases, they are not aware of why they have been detained. In many cases, their pre-trial detention continues to be renewed again and again.
Ravina Shamdasani is the spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office. Cuban doctors arrive in Kenya to the chagrin of Doctors Union. And parents pull their girls from a Nairobi school after rape allegations. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. English-speaking Cameroonians have put forth demands that they hope will end ongoing insurrection by the self-proclaimed Amazonian separatists. The demands include a repeal of an anti-terrorism law, a federal system, and a general amnesty for those arrested during protests in 2016. But a spokesperson for the Amazonian movement says the group wants nothing short of an independent southern Cameroon. A commission set up by President Paul Biya, in power for 35 years, said the recommendations came after consulting with traditional religious and political leaders in the Anglophone region. Nijon Frundi is founder and chairman of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He says the ball is now in President Paul Biya's court.
It's for the Anglophone teachers and lawyers and all the people that out of anger they've been pushed the wall and they're in the bush now fighting. It's not a matter of might accepting. If the government thinks that these are his people and he has to take care of them, he should take care of them in every aspect. Because from Tabia to declare war without consulting the leadership of the Anglophones, are people there that every day they send him motions of support calling on him to be their presidential candidate. Well, we want to assume that these are people who love him. And for the sake of those people, I think he should have at least talked to them to find out what they could do than single-handedly declare war at the airport on his return from Europe.
Mr. Frundi, since you attended this meeting, you were invited. Did this meeting include members of the separatist movement? Were they also invited?
Well, most of them are in the bush and some are abroad with you in the United States and Europe. So they couldn't have been invited. But that's why they are recommending to Mr. Biya that for him to open an inclusive dialogue, all these representatives from Europe, America, and everywhere, South Africa, Nigeria, should come down for a talk. And he is saying that he cannot talk to terrorists and separatists and all the like. Let General Ojukwu cause a Biafran war, but in the end, the Nigerian government reconciled with him. He came back home, died, and was given a state burial.
Mr. Frundi, as you know, the leaders of this separatist movement are in jail. They were taken to Cameroon from Nigeria. Those of you who attended the meeting, did you ask, as part of this amnesty, for the government to release the leaders of the movement?
We are not just asking for the release of the leaders of the movement. We are asking for the release of all Anglophones who have been arrested in and out of the country because of this struggle. We're asking for their immediate release and conditional amnesty granted to those that are on the run and outside and cannot come back home for now.
So as part of the discussion, you also talked about a federal system for Cameroon?
Yeah, the federal system has been the SDF proposal for governance from 1990. From 1990, the SDF saw this and saw that there was no justice in our land and Anglophones were never loved. And so we thought if we had the federal system of governance and the budgetary locations for the Anglophone areas given, they were going to take care of the educational setup in the way they think would best fit their children, to take care of the legal systems. But they tell you that they want a decentralized system where they still have everything under control, and which is what they've been doing. And that's why Anglophones are not comfortable and happy at all.
Mr. Fundi, you have been part of the political system for some time, and you know that people in the English-speaking part of the country have long complained about being marginalized. What makes you think now that President Paul Biya is going to listen?
Well, we gave it time. And since he couldn't listen amicably, that's why the younger people now have taken to the bushes to start fighting, killing themselves from both sides, from the army and from the civilian side. This is what is before him now, and the blood is flowing. If he doesn't want to listen, it means that he wants more blood to flow, and who knows where it will end.
Nijan Frundi is the founder and chairman of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He was speaking with me from Yaoundé. The UN Human Rights Office has condemned the most recent crackdown against activists, bloggers, and journalists in Egypt as a violation of their rights to freedom of expression, association, and assembly. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In recent weeks, the UN Human Rights Office has reported that prominent bloggers, activists, and journalists have been arbitrarily arrested and subjected to interrogation while in detention on spurious charges of peddling fake news. In one instance, it notes an activist, Amal Fati, was picked up and charged with using the internet and social media to spread false news to push forward a supposed terrorist agenda. Human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says it is not possible to know how many people have been detained for exercising the rights of freedom of expression. She says their conditions of confinement are of concern, as their rights to due process are not being respected.
In many cases, these people are detained without an arrest warrant. In some cases, they are not aware of why they have been detained. In many cases, their pre-trial detention continues to be renewed again and again. And in some of the cases that I mentioned, three individuals have been detained since March, since the end of February, early March, and their detention, pre-trial detention, keeps getting renewed for 15-day periods successively.
Shamdasani says some of the charges carry long prison terms. The UN Human Rights Office is calling for the immediate and unconditional release of all those currently being held by the Egyptian authorities. Officials are urging the government to respect its obligations under international human rights law. According to the Reuters news agency, the Egyptian state news agency, MENA, reports that President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has pardoned 712 prisoners who were jailed for anti-government protests. The president was re-elected for a second term in March and sworn in recently. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni says his government will continue to invest in infrastructure, mainly roads and electricity. The president says these will help accelerate economic development. But a senior member of the main opposition party says Mr. Museveni must first fight corruption if the country is to develop. Mugumi Davis Rakarich has details from Kampala.
In his State of the Nation address Wednesday, President Museveni said the Ugandan economy continues to be vibrant despite local and international economic challenges. Mr. Museveni said Uganda's economy will grow by 5.8% from just 4% last year. He attributes this to the government's investment in infrastructure.
These investments in the roads and in electricity, along with the earlier decision 2001 of strengthening the army, are beginning to result in the resumption of our usual high growth rates, which had been interfered with by the shortage of electricity and more recently by the drought. This year, for instance, the economy will grow by 5.8% per annum. This will rise to 7% per annum by the financial year 2019-2010.
The president said electricity generation will help foster development since it lowers the cost of production. He also said the government will avail credit facilities to start up local industries.
Our industrial sector, therefore, will not only depend on processing agricultural and mineral products. Because, you see, my strategy which I would like you to support. We should process all these agricultural products ourselves, but also process the minerals.
The president said supporting local industries means that Ugandans will have alternative locally manufactured products, thus reducing foreign deficit. The local industries, the president says, will create employment opportunities for thousands of unemployed Ugandans, mainly the youth. He said farmers who form more than 60% of the population will be supported to practice modern farming methods.
It is only agriculture that is still growing slowly. Fortunately, we have or will soon have the necessary boosters for agriculture. This will be the use of fertilizers by more Ugandan farmers than at present, and the farmers will use more irrigation.
But Harold Kaija, the Deputy Secretary General of Uganda's largest opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, says Uganda cannot develop unless the president fights nepotism and mismanagement of government funds.
He's saying things that we know would please anybody who is an onlooker. The level of corruption, the level of extravagance, the size of the high size of his cabinet. You know, every time we're in elections, every time he's demarcating small proportion, that actually the cost of most of the biggest part of the budget is put in administration. So in that way, very little is actually put in the real production. And when you don't produce, you don't earn.
Critics of the government also oppose the newly suggested taxes that include tax on internet data, mobile money, and on agriculture. But President Museveni maintains that with improved security, education, health, ICT, and infrastructure development, Uganda is simply unstoppable in development. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 7th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Ethiopia said this week it will give back to Eritrea a long disputed swath of land. The executive committee of the ruling EPRDF coalition said it will adhere to the terms of the Algiers Agreement. The international community backed the ruling, signed in 2002, and both sides agreed to the United Nations Boundary Commission's terms. Leah Breitmeyer is the Howell M. Holtzman Professor of International Law at the Yale Law School.
There have been other times that they said that they were going to act in line with it. When they said they accepted it, that everything was going to be implemented according to the Algiers Agreement, there have been times that they said this before, and it's always turned out to be some kind of trick that they say that they're going to do it, and then they try to maneuver to get some kind of advantage out of doing this. So it's impossible to know what the intent is. If a statement is made in good faith and they implement it, that would be great.
And so what would that look like on the ground, implementing the Boundary Commission's decision?
Well, it's relatively straightforward to withdraw all of the Ethiopian forces from the areas that were awarded to Eritrea by the Boundary Commission in 2003. It's a very simple matter to do that. There's no particular logistical problems. I guess it could probably be done in a very short period of time just by vacating the area.
Mm-hmm. And some argue that the Eritrean government also has been, focusing on this Boundary Commission's decision to militarize the country. What's expected from the Eritrean side? Is there anything that should be followed through?
There isn't anything they should do that they didn't already have an obligation to do. There's no conditions remaining outstanding for the Eritreans to satisfy. They've done everything that they were expected to do under the Algiers Agreement. I believe that there's no territory award to Ethiopia that's occupied by Eritrea. That's my belief. So there's nothing for Eritrea to do. It's done everything that it needed to do. The international community may have things that it wants from Eritrea, but they're completely separate from the Boundary Commission, and they don't give Ethiopia any excuse for postponing the implementation of the decision.
Do you think this would bring lasting peace in the region if this is implemented?
It's certainly a very important step in the right direction. Countries need to know that they can count on one another to comply with the obligations they've assumed. You can't have a neighbor that makes promises and then, when it's dissatisfied with the outcome of the case, refuses to comply. You can't get along in a neighborly way with a country that doesn't honor its obligations. So it's going to be a huge contribution. It's a huge first step and a necessary first step. Whether it means lasting peace, well, I guess that's anybody's guess, but I'd like to hope so.
Leah Braemeyer is the Howell M. Hostman Professor of International Law at the Yale University Law School. She spoke with viewer Salim Solomon. In March, Kenya agreed to accelerate a health agreement signed with Cuba last year to bring in 100 doctors. The doctors who have started arriving in Kenya are meant to fill what the government has termed gaps in county hospitals. But the Kenyan Doctors Union thinks those gaps should be filled by locals. Rael Ombo reports from Nairobi.
The first group of 50 Cuban medics arrived late Tuesday and were welcomed at the airport by top government officials and representatives from Kenya's Ministry of Health. A second group of 50 arrives Thursday. Thereafter, the doctors will be posted to various hospitals in Kenya's 47 counties. Each county is expected to get at least two doctors. However, the Kenya Medical Pharmacists and Dentists Union is criticizing the deal, insisting Kenyan doctors could have been trained and hired for the positions. Samuel Roko is KMPDU's chair.
Our appeal and our advice is, as we consider to bring in expertise from other countries, need to exhaust what we have locally, and if we lack capacity locally, then we should focus on training our own so that they can be used to manage our patients in Kenya.
KMPDU says more than 1,200 Kenyan doctors were unemployed as of May 2017.
We do have a number of doctors who have qualified, both general practitioners and specialists who are not being employed and they are Kenyan.
This is not the first time the Kenyan government has tried to import medical staff. Last year, when Kenyan doctors went on strike for better pay and working conditions, KMPDU blocked attempts to bring in doctors from Tanzania. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Health, Cicely Kariuki, has stated in the past that the country does not have enough specialists. She said that Kenya stands to learn lessons from Cuba's many years of providing universal health coverage to its citizens. She said Cuba has a strong primary health care model that, in her words, Kenya is now pursuing.
There is every conviction that we need to reorient our approach and to give more focus to preventive as opposed to curative approach, which is currently how our health sector is oriented.
Over the past 50 years, Cuba has consistently used the export of its doctors as a powerful and far-reaching tool of health diplomacy. It sent its first doctors overseas as far back as 1963, and to date has sent physicians to over 100 countries. Uganda's government is also making plans to hire Cuban doctors due to a shortage of medical specialists in the country. According to the deal, Uganda will hire at least 200 doctors, a move that the doctors' union in Uganda is also against. Rael Ombor, for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Nairobi, parents stormed a girls' boarding school on Monday this week and took away their children, accusing administrators of failing to protect the students. The incident was a reaction to the rape of three girls last Friday at the school. As Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA, Kenyan police are investigating and Parliament is also getting involved.
No, I'm asking. She was doing a patrol in here. She walked out.
The parliamentary committee tasked to look into education spent March of Wednesday at Moi Girls in Nairobi, where three girls were reportedly raped Friday. The committee was on a mission to understand how the rapes happened and who has information that could help police. The pressing issue for the committee was, what time did the rape occur and did anyone hear anything?
A lot is being reported of around 5. Now in the imagination of everybody and even the school, what time do you think this incident actually happened? Because everybody's talking and getting information around 5, 5 or 8. Mm-hmm. And by that time, the gun was dressed and seated in a bed. So what time could it have occurred in the night?
According to the school officials, there is just one female guard watching the girls' dormitory. The guard said she had nothing out of the ordinary at the time of the rapes. One official told the committee the first sound the guard heard was the students getting ready for their classes on Saturday morning.
She heard the girls' noise at around 5, and they were waking up to freshen up. And she opened the gate for the girls to fetch water. And then after that, she actually met with the matron, and the matron is the one who narrated the story of what happened at night.
Minister of Education Amina Mohammed said Tuesday the security systems failed the students.
It has been established that various security gaps and lapses existed at the school by the time of the reported defilement incident. To address this, the ministry has ordered an overhaul of the entire security system, including the replacement of all existing security agents.
The minister also dissolved the Board of Management and Parents Association of the school. Police have taken the DNA samples of all the male teachers, relatives and workers of the school to establish who was behind the rape. Results of the test are expected next week. Meanwhile, the government has deployed police officers at the school in an effort to assure parents the premises are safe. Students are expected to return this Sunday. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The High Court of Malawi has given the government 30 days to transfer all children detained in prisons pending trial to safe homes or to a reformatory home. The judgment comes after rights activists questioned the constitutionality of detaining children in prisons. Lamech Masina reports from Blantyre.
Chikonde Chijozi is the Deputy Executive Director for the Center for Human Rights Education, Advice and Assistance, which pushed for the release of child prisoners. She says child advocacy groups found that more than 50 children were detained at the Vumbwe and Kajere prisons.
Originally, Vumbwe and Kajere were designated to be prisons for young offenders, meaning people who are above 18 and but less than 25 years of age. But then we found that even children younger than 14 were being housed in the same prison with these young offenders who are in principle adults.
And the Malawi Constitution says that children in trouble with the law should be imprisoned as last resort, and that imprisoned children should be separated from adults. And a law passed in 2010 bans imprisoning children for any offense. On Wednesday, the High Court ordered that courts should enforce the Constitution and the law within 30 days. 2 years ago, the Inspectorate of Prisons told Parliament that the two prisons had severe food shortages, lacked running water, and had poorly ventilated toilets and cells. Courts that have sent children to these prisons said they did so because the two youth reformatory centers were too far from the courts handling the young suspects' cases. The High Court also ordered that the lower-ranked magistrates should not preside over child justice courts unless designated by the Chief Justice. It said that the children tried before the lower-ranking magistrates should be retried before a properly constituted child justice court within 30 days. Malik Munela is the president for the Media Advocacy for the Advancement of Child Rights.
It's high time we considered putting in place facilities that will help comply with the law, because having two wonderful laws and facing challenges to implement those laws because of infrastructural challenges is very unfortunate.
Rights activists plan to soon meet the Registrar of the High Court, the police and Minister of Gender and Child Affairs authorities to ensure that the High Court ruling is put into effect. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, for sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington saying have a good day, Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.05 and 20.05 UTC, right after the international news.